Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a book for history buffs. The legacy of Napoleon has long fascinated historians and scholars alike, and as a result, there have been hundreds, even thousands of books that have been written about nearly every aspect of his life and reign. My guest today adds to that list with a new book that focuses on the French Emperor's fall. But what is the relevance of the Napoleonic era for 21st century life? European historian Monroe Price says that most people remember Napoleon's fall for two events, the retreat from Moscow and his defeat at Waterloo. But there were 3 years intervening between those events, with peace conferences, with offers where Napoleon could have continued to rule France and many of her immediate neighbors. It could have changed the course of Europe. But for the French emperor, it was all or nothing. Price writes that his refusal to compromise doomed him to lose his empire. His book, Napoleon, End of Glory, published by Oxford University Press, explores how ego and megalomania blinded the leader to his inevitable end when pragmatism might have altered the course of Europe. Monroe Price is a professor of modern European history at Bradford University in the UK, and has written several books on French history surrounding the French Revolution and the Napoleonic era. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Monroe Price, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
What is the importance of Napoleon today to a, you know, early 21st century? How is Napoleon still important? What can we learn from Napoleon and this short, brilliant flash and fall reign of Napoleon?
There are several things, really. I mean, the first is he's obviously extremely important for France today and for modern French history, because he's the person who resolved, you know, the founding event of modern France, which was also an extremely violent and divisive one, which was the French Revolution of 1789. I mean, he brought things together. He was the great reconciler, really. And in the wake of this, he was also a brilliant administrator. He wasn't just a fantastic soldier. He's one of the great military geniuses of all time. He was also a remarkable politician and administrator. And really, on the back of resolving the French Revolution, he gave France the institutional, the legal, political, and often religious institutions and administrative institutions that she still has today. I mean, the French Civil Code, the Napoleonic Code, is still the basis of French civil law today. Just to give one example, the system of government of France, the division of France into these regions, the departments, each with a prefect nominated by the ministry in Paris, comes directly from Napoleon. So he's left a tremendous legacy to France today. Also, he was one of the first people in modern history to attempt to unify Europe. And as we can see today, the whole issue of the unity or the disunity of Europe, with all the upheavals over the EU and its extension and the crisis of the euro, is still very much with us today.
Now, in unifying Europe, let's talk about that, because it was unifying Europe under French rule by force. Was it just the typical empire building that was prominent in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century of if you're a country, your main goal is to extend your reach and power?
This is a fascinating point, and it's still among historians and commentators, it's a really controversial point. The debate really is whether Napoleon's aim was rational at the beginning and whether that was simply to confirm France within the expanded boundaries that years of victory in the Wars of the French Revolution had given it, which was basically the so-called natural frontiers of France, which was the River Rhine to the north and east, the Alps to the south and east, and the Pyrenees bordering Spain in the bottom, and obviously the Atlantic Ocean and the North Sea to the west. And this was sort of expanded France. The French forces, the expansionist forces of the French Revolution had achieved by the late 1790s. And at first it looks as if Napoleon is satisfied more or less with those boundaries. At a certain point, around sort of 1805, 1806, 1807, basically, it's difficult quite to pinpoint it, he seems to get wider and grander ideas and seems to think of moving from a sort of expanded France to what you could call a Roman-style empire of the whole of Europe and even beyond, ruled by Paris. And this, of course, is where, I mean, people have said, you know, he became megalomaniac or went mad. Certainly we can say that at this point, ultimately he bit off more than he can chew and raised such resistance in the other countries of Europe that eventually he was overthrown. But it's a very controversial point. At what point exactly, what were his aims, and at what point exactly they became megalomaniac?
Well, it's always interesting to me what motivates somebody. You know, it's one thing to rule your country. In the case of Napoleon, at this point, he pretty much ruled it absolutely, and to go beyond his borders and to conquer the world, whether it's Alexander the Great, Napoleon, or there's been a handful of others that have always tried to sort of conquer the known world, if you will.
Exactly.
What motivates? I mean, is it just a matter of megalomania?
It's funny because up to now my books have been about other figures in modern French and European history who generally they haven't been geniuses like King Louis the 16th or Marie Antoinette or King Louis Philippe, the last French king, but they've all been more or less rational. This is the first time I've had to deal with someone who is a towering figure, who really is a genius. And I must say, I find it very difficult and sometimes disturbing trying to get into the mind of someone like that. It's very, very difficult. All one can say, I think, is that from the beginning, from childhood, without being too Freudian about it, Napoleon did have a tremendous sense of himself, a driving will, a driving urge for domination. He certainly dominated his family from a very early age. And he had a tremendous imagination and tremendous intelligence and skill. And I think also what's important here is he had a very good education in military college in France. And among this, a key part of his education was a lot of reading among classical Greek and Roman authors. And it's through these, people like Plutarch particularly, Plutarch's Lives, that Napoleon was introduced to the people who became his great heroes throughout his life, who were Julius Caesar, and above all, Alexander the Great. And I think at a certain point, and it's difficult to tell because the documents aren't there for Napoleon's youth, he did, slightly alarmingly, begin to identify with Julius Caesar, and particularly Alexander the Great. And there are certain points in his life, particularly when he embarked on this extraordinary and partially insane, I think, overwhelmingly ambitious attempt to conquer Egypt to go beyond Europe in 1798 to 99. At that point, for example, he does explicitly identify himself with Alexander and thinks of following in Alexander's footsteps to conquer as much of India as he can, for example.
So your story follows the last 3 years of Napoleon's reign. The tide has turned. He is retreating from Moscow. In fact, he leaves his army on the battle and heads back to France. At this point, it seems like, you know, a rational person would say, well, it's time to cut my losses, make peace. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, as your book points out, he was unable to make any sort of peace.
Absolutely. And there are various ways, I think, of looking at this. One is the straight psychological megalomania angle. This was someone who did nothing by half measures. By this time, he'd become in love with his own myth, basically. Another thing which is quite interesting is he probably also thought, given his family history, that he would die young. And he was reconciled to not having a long and peaceful old age, because his family generally died in their 40s or 50s of stomach cancer. And I think he was, from realizing this, if I can psychologize, I think he was quite reconciled to the fact that if he was going to go out young, he would go out in a blaze of glory. So I think there's that sort of medical, psychological dimension to it as well. Also, he had this from Corsican myth and legend and the folk tales and myths of his early life in Corsica. He had a tremendous sense of his own destiny, an almost a fatalistic sense of his own destiny. And he thought that when the time came for him to fall, he would fall, and there wasn't much he could do about it. And he didn't really see much point in trying to quibble with the designs of fate or providence or the gods however you want to put it. So that, I think, is an important mystical psychological aspect of why Napoleon refused to compromise. The other thing, which is more rational, I think, which is something I've explored in the most detail and tried to in my book, because I think it's been the least explored, is that I think from his words to a number of people in those 3 years, Napoleon was genuinely convinced that if he made an inglorious peace, a peace that wasn't glorious to the French people, they would rise up and overthrow him because he had betrayed what were by then 2 decades of military glory and military success.
And this got into something I was really interested in, because we think of Napoleon, once he becomes the emperor, as pretty much having unlimited power. He can move armies halfway across the continent, completely across the continent for that matter. But it sounds like he felt like he had real constraints from the people. Was it the experience of the French Revolution, of knowing that the people could rise up and depose a king or a monarch?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's a very good way of putting it, actually. What's interesting is that Napoleon had experienced some of the bloodiest scenes of the French Revolution as a young man. The first actual fighting he'd seen had been the massacre by the Paris crowd of the Swiss Guard defending the King and Queen in the Tuileries, leading to the deposition and ultimately the execution of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. And Napoleon wasn't alone in this. Anybody who lived through the French Revolution, particularly in Paris, right into the middle 19th century, was absolutely traumatized by the violence they'd seen. It was the first time in living memory that these sort of scenes had happened and led to such an immense change in the government and society of a country, like a major European country, like France. And the interesting thing is that actually, I think you're right. I think Napoleon did have pretty well unlimited power after he came to power in 1799, and particularly after he made himself emperor of the French in 1804. He had an extremely good police service. He had this extremely effective army. He had an obedient people who were delighted to have been delivered from what they saw as the virtual civil war and the chaos of the revolution. The extraordinary thing is that even someone as powerful as Napoleon was so traumatized by what he'd seen as a young man in the French Revolution that it never left him. And what never left him particularly was the conviction that if things started to go wrong again, and particularly if the war started to go badly, it could all rise up again and engulf him.
Mm. My guest today is Monroe Price, a professor of modern European history at Bradford University in the UK and the author of a new Oxford University Press book, Napoleon, End of Glory. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. The book follows the final 3 years of Napoleon's reign, beginning with retreat from Moscow, which he basically went home to form a new army, because he had basically destroyed the army that had attacked Moscow. And yet, we think of the retreat of Moscow, and then we think of Waterloo, and we don't really think much of in between. In fact, those 3 years are really filled with a lot of intrigue, a lot of opportunities for him to conclude a peace that would have seemingly allowed France to have far more influence than eventually it did by, 1815.
Absolutely. The sheer scale of the losses Napoleon's of the French army, and not the French army, was actually a European army under French control that invaded Russia in 1812. Of 600,000 who invade Russia, roughly 100 or 120,000 survive. In such a short period of time, it's an unprecedented military disaster. I suspect proportionately it's a worse military disaster than that which engulfs Hitler's Wehrmacht when it invades Russia, having learned nothing from Napoleon in 1941. But certainly, I think there's a tendency among readers and historians to fast forward from this disaster at Moscow in 1812 to the final defeat at Waterloo in June 1815, and not to realise that there are these three crucial years in between. And the key thing, I think, about this is that even after the tremendous disaster of the retreat from Moscow and the loss of these hundreds of thousands of men, Napoleon still controlled a large part of Europe. As you say, he was able, with his extraordinary energy he had, to raise a new army of about 200,000 more men. And therefore, it's in the 2 years following the retreat from Moscow with this new army, 1812 to 1814, that he really loses the redoubt in Europe, basically, the empire and France itself, that the retreat from Moscow had still left him with. And I think that the causes of this are as much personal, psychological, and diplomatic as military in Napoleon's case.
Mm. And there were numerous proposals out there which would have left France in fairly good shape. In fact, one of the last proposals still left him in charge.
Yes. All of them, they were basically between 1813 and 1814, there were three separate proposals, basically, because, in fact, it was in the interests of a number of the other European powers. They didn't want an overweening Napoleon, but for various reasons, partly to keep the forces of the French Revolution in check, basically, they still wanted a relatively weakened and reasonable Napoleon left in charge of France. The first offer, which was made in 1813 at the so-called Congress of Prague, left Napoleon not only with an expanded France, but considerable power over Italy as well. The second one gave France, as I said before, the so-called natural frontiers. And the last peace offer, which was made just 3 weeks before Napoleon was actually deposed, had to sign his abdication, would have given Napoleon a less dramatic, a shorter border, basically, France's borders before the French Revolution, the 1789, but they would still have left him as Emperor of the French, still in charge of France. And basically, this wasn't, even then, 3 weeks from his abdication, this wasn't enough for Napoleon.
It's interesting, you said, you know, basically the Allies against France feared the forces of the French Revolution, so they felt like it was probably in their best interest to weaken Napoleon but keep him as emperor so that he would establish a line and become a monarch like the rest of them?
Absolutely. I mean, if you take this fascinating figure, who, of course, was Henry Kissinger's great subject before Kissinger made the move from being historian to going into politics and diplomacy. Prince Metternich, the Austrian mm-hmm. foreign minister. Yeah. I mean, Metternich was a very conservative man. He loathed the French Revolution. On the other hand, he saw the advantages of keeping in power someone with the strength and the military know-how to keep what he really feared, the mob, basically, under control. And it's only when Napoleon constantly refuses, and Metternich is the man who's behind all these peace offers to Napoleon, essentially, on behalf of the Allies, and it's only at the very end when it's perfectly clear that Napoleon is incapable of cutting a reasonable deal, basically, that Metternich gives up on him and decides all he and the Allies can do, is restore the previous French royal family that had ruled before the Revolution.
The Bourbons,
The Bourbon, yes. Yeah. But certainly inherent in this deal of Napoleon, as you say, remaining ruler of France, is that he will, his son, who is by then the so-called King of Rome, who is by then three, will inherit, and Napoleon will be given the chance, okay, not in the context of a huge empire, but certainly in the context of a France no smaller than she'd been before the French Revolution, to found a dynasty.
It's interesting, really interesting, because it seemed, as I was reading through this, it just seemed like Napoleon was a guy who cannot take yes for an answer.
Well, it is extraordinary. I think that, and one mustn't over-egg the psychologizing, but there is a degree of delusion there. And I think you've got it absolutely right that there are two parts of this delusion. One is a straight psychological delusion, stemming from megalomania and enormous pride, and just not being able to accept a shrunken dominion, which was all that was on offer after the retreat from Moscow. On the other hand, there's a more rational delusion based on genuine fear of, you know, a fear that at least has a rational basis in something that had previously happened, which was the destructive capability of the French Revolution.
By 1814, not only has he lost in his bid to go to Russia, he's been forced back across Europe from Prussia, or what we now say is Germany, into France. He's at Fontainebleau. You know, the Prussians are in Paris, and he's say, let's march on Paris. And finally, it's his generals. You know, what it really struck me is almost like a leader of a military junta. In many ways, because he really, you know, as long as the generals support him, he had the power.
Absolutely. That comparison with a junta has been made by, you know, one of the most eminent American historians, Paul Schroeder, who's just retired as professor at Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, in his marvelous book, The Transformation of European Politics, dealing with this era. He says that, in a way, part of Napoleon's legacy was to South America this tradition of military rule by junta. And it's, after all, it's no coincidence that the initial liberators and rulers of South America, like Higgins and Bolivar, modeled themselves very much on Napoleon. I mean, he did, in this sense, begin a tradition. I think that's absolutely correct, because basically his power rests on the army. For someone like this, who isn't prepared to compromise, and is either arrogant or genuinely fearful of some sort of diplomatic compromise that will mean he has to govern more or less as a civilian ruler, and who therefore decides to throw the dice in a military sense, to stake everything basically on the military outcome, on the battlefield. But obviously his army becomes important, and his generals and his marshals above all become extremely important. Now, the trouble with Napoleon here is that his sort of 18 or 20 top generals, his marshals, to tie them to him in the course of the previous 10, 15 years, he'd given them enormous estates, wealth, titles, privileges. And this was a rather, you know, ultimately a short-sighted thing to do, because Napoleon didn't mind going down with the ship, but these marshals of his, particularly Marshal Ney, the so-called bravest of the brave, they may have been very brave on the battlefield, but they did want to live to enjoy what they'd gained from Napoleon and from their military prowess. And finally, what happens, the final thing that brings Napoleon down, is, as you say, at Fontainebleau, just outside Paris, they finally say to him, no, we've had enough. We want to go home with our families, not be killed or die of disease, and enjoy our well or ill-gotten gains. And that's finally what forces Napoleon to sign his abdication.
Of course, he went to Elba, but he was only there for a year or less.
Yeah, less.
And the Bourbons' rule proved to be so unpopular that he's able to come back from exile. And, of course, the final 100 days where he raised an army, comes back to Paris to momentous cheers. And, of course, he then goes to Waterloo and meets his Waterloo, as we like to say. But you say, you know, this was all doomed. There was no way he was going to capture any sort of glory. As soon as he took power, everybody was allied against France, and they were going to make sure that he was gone.
Yes, I mean, this is why I think that the previous 2 years, 1813 to 14, are the important ones, and not 1815 in Waterloo, because after 1813 and after in 1813 and 14, even despite the Russian disaster, Napoleon still had the remnants of an empire and all of France to lose. He was still an established European ruler, a European monarch. After Fontainebleau, after April 1814, he's abdicated. He's been given this tiny island off the Italian coast, off Tuscany, Elba. He's been recognized as sovereign of Elba. But the moment he abandons that, for all sorts of reasons, and goes back to France to try and claim his former power again, the other European powers regard him as an outlaw, and in their eyes, he is an outlaw. They declare him such, which means that if at any point an assassin had been able to get within shooting or stabbing distance of Napoleon during the Hundred Days, his actions would have been condoned by the other European powers. He was an outlaw to that extent. Mm. And I think if you put yourself beyond the pale to that extent, it's very difficult to come back.
Mm. My guest today, Monroe Price, his book is titled Napoleon, End of Glory. Well, are there lessons that apply to 21st century world affairs from the end of the Napoleonic era, or is this just an interesting story from our history that sort of helps explain France today and explains the borders of Europe?
The one specific moral, I think, of Napoleon's story, which may be relevant today, though I'm sure the U.S. is not thinking of doing this, is never invade Russia. That's the main thing. You know, regardless of what happens in the Ukraine, for heaven's sake, don't get involved in anything resembling a land war with Russia. You won't win. So that's the key thing. And perhaps the moral might be, always be prepared to admit that you're wrong. Napoleon was very rarely, if ever, able to admit that he was wrong, and I think that led him into a number of his greatest mistakes. And it's significant that the only times Napoleon ever in his life admitted he was wrong or had been wrong was when he'd finally reaped the consequences of his obstinacy, and it ended up on this tiny rock in the South Atlantic, St. Helena. Then, talking voluminously as he did to his secretary, dictating his memoirs, he was able then once or twice to admit he had been wrong. And so basically, if you don't want to end up on St. Helena, if you're a ruler, try admitting you're wrong now and then.
All right. Monroe Price, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
Monroe Price is a professor of modern European history at Bradford University and the author of Napoleon, The End of Glory, a new book from Oxford University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.